Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Chris Vanderbilt, and I'm joined today by the expert synthesizer of macro trends and market mechanics, Alex Astor.
It's great to be back. Today, we are undertaking a very necessary deep dive into a massive stack of source material.
And what have we got?
It's Barron's Magazine for the week of November 24th, 2025. And this issue is absolutely packed. I mean, it's giving us a comprehensive look at technology shifts, global financial movements, some critical policy developments, and all the market stats published by Dow Jones and Company.
That's right. And our mission this week is, well, it's critical. We need to cut through all the complexity, you know, the AI hysteria, the retirement fears, these surprising global policy pivots, and really extract the most crucial high-impact insights for you.
The goal is to deliver actionable, well-contextualized knowledge quickly.
Exactly. And we're starting immediately with a frankly stunning claim that really reorients how we look at the global financial control panel.
It is a stunning claim.
Right.
The conventional wisdom, you know, it always puts the Federal Reserve at the center of global market movement. But our sources argue, and I think quite convincingly, that the key to global financial stability right now isn't the Fed. It is Japanese policy, specifically the actions of the Bank of Japan, or the BOJ.
I find this idea absolutely fascinating. I mean, Japan has been synonymous with decades of ultra-low rates, an economy that's often described as, you know, dormant.
Mm.
And now, suddenly, they are positioned as the linchpin of global liquidity. Okay, let's unpack this. How exactly does Japan, and not the Fed, hold the global market's fate in its hands?
Well, it's fundamentally about the global supply of cheap money. It's about liquidity injection. For decades, the BOJ's ultra-loose monetary policy, with rates near zero, meant Japanese investors. We're talking major financial institutions, pension funds, life insurance companies.
The big players.
The really big players. They were forced to look abroad for any kind of yield. So they exported capital globally, injecting just vast amounts of liquidity into the system.
And that had the effect of suppressing our bond yields, right? Western bond yields.
Exactly. Particularly U.S. Treasury yields. Yeah. It kept them below the levels that our own government's massive fiscal deficits would otherwise require. It was effectively a global subsidy on borrowing.
That makes sense. That decades-long supply of Japanese capital really helped keep the party going in the West. But now we're seeing the BOJ under pressure to change course, and it's primarily because of the sliding yen.
Precisely. The yen recently hit 158 to the dollar, and it's flirting dangerously close to that psychological and, frankly, political line in the sand of 160.
160 is the number to watch.
It is. And if the Bank of Japan decides it has to raise rates or intervene significantly to halt that slide and strengthen the yen, that global liquidity tap is suddenly shut off. The reversal of this dynamic is what makes Japan the unexpected key player.
Wait, I need to understand the mechanism here. When the BOJ intervenes to strengthen the yen, how does that specifically tighten dollar liquidity for, say, a bank in London or a factory in Vietnam? Can you explain that transmission mechanism a little more clearly?
Certainly. It's a great question.
Mm.
So when the DOJ decides to strengthen the yen, they have to buy yen. And they typically do so by selling dollars.
And where do those dollars come from?
They're massive holdings of U.S. Treasury securities. So when the Bank of Japan unloads billions of dollars worth of treasuries onto the market, they're increasing the supply of bonds, which pushes prices down and yields up, not just in Japan, but globally.
Uh-huh.
But more importantly, they are physically pulling dollars out of the global market system that's used for trade and financing. This action effectively tightens dollar liquidity worldwide, reversing that whole decades-long process of Japanese fund injection.
So it's a double whammy. It raises global borrowing costs and physically reduces the availability of the U.S. dollar in foreign exchange markets. And we're already seeing warning signs of this reversal in Japan's domestic bond market, correct?
Absolutely. Japanese government bond, or JGB, yields have already risen sharply just on the expectation of a policy change. This is the domestic signal.
Okay.
Now that JGBs offer more attractive yield, crucial domestic investors, like those Japanese life insurance companies we mentioned, they no longer have the incentive to buy high-volume, hedged U.S. treasuries. They can just invest at home.
Which reverses the capital flow.
It fundamentally reverses capital flow out of the U.S. fixed income market and poses a massive headwind for global fixed income.
That's a profound, complex, and crucial macro point. And speaking of fixed income headwinds, let's pivot to Europe, where the sources suggest that the inability to balance the books has led to the return of a familiar adversary, the bond vigilantes.
Yes.
They have Europe in a serious bind.
They absolutely do. And it is a clear, current illustration of how financial markets can dictate fiscal policy, even without a formal, you know, headline-grabbing crisis.
Right.
The enduring specter of the 2022 Liz Truss mini-budget debacle, where a head of lettuce famously outlasted her premiership.
I remember that, a head of lettuce.
That event showed investors that political instability tied to fiscal profligacy has immediate painful market consequences. That memory still haunts European governments struggling with high debt and high deficits.
It's an almost painful benchmark for government credibility, but it underscores the stakes. Where is this pressure most acute right now?
The UK is the prime example. The government, currently led by Prime Minister Starmer and Finance Minister Reeves, is struggling to plug a significant fiscal hole. The deficit is running high at 4.8% of GDP, and the national debt has ballooned over 100%.
And politically, they're trapped.
Completely. They face immense political pressure because they are reluctant to implement either widely unpopular tax hikes or deep spending cuts, the two levers they need to pull to prove solvency to the market.
But aren't bond vigilantes often dismissed as a bogeyman? Or, you know, a convenient political excuse for tax hikes? Is the market really dictating policy, or is it just providing a cover for unpopular decisions?
The market is definitely providing the incentive structure, and that structure is undeniable. It's quantifiable. Nomura estimates that even a modest 1% rise in UK 10-year gilt yields, it drives up the government's annual interest payments by a staggering £10 billion. That cost is immediate, it's real, and it drains money that could otherwise go to public services.
So the vigilantes demand fiscal responsibility.
They do. And if governments delay austerity or new taxes, markets step in and raise the borrowing costs automatically, making fiscal policy painful by default. Even centrist European parties recognize this threat. But as we see in the UK, political calculus often favors avoiding unpopular decisions, which only exacerbates the market's impatience.
This sounds like a problem contained to Europe's higher debt nations, but the sources link this European bind to a critical warning for the U.S.
It is a critical linkage that American investors have to internalize. I mean, if we look at the U.S. future, particularly under a potential Trump administration, or really any administration that continues this pattern of massive deficit spending, the risk is identical.
Right.
Trump's signature tax bill, approved in July, is expected to add trillions of dollars to the deficit over the next decade, accelerating the growth of the national debt. Europe offers a stark preview of the cost of this trajectory.
Which is what, exactly?
That debt risk will inevitably push up borrowing costs for the U.S. government. And by extension, for every ordinary American seeking a mortgage, a car loan, or business financing. The U.S. is not immune from the bond market's demands for solvency, and the increasing interest cost is the silent tax on fiscal profligacy.
That's a powerful macro warning. But moving from global policy fears to a truly compelling investment narrative, the sources signal a strong case for Europe's revival.
Absolutely. Europe is unequivocally back on investors' maps. Mm-hmm. And it's not just a marginal improvement. I mean, non-U.S. stocks are enjoying their strongest rally in 30 years.
30 years.
The MSCI Europe Index is up a resounding 27% year-to-date in U.S. dollar terms. That soundly beats the S&P 500's 12% gain. This is a massive rotation.
Okay, let's unpack this. Why is Europe rallying now after more than a decade of serious underperformance and, you know, malaise following the financial crisis and a Eurozone debt crisis?
It's a compelling convergence of three factors. First, policy normalization. Europe is finally emerging into a much more normal monetary and fiscal policy environment, recovering from that lull of negative rates.
And normal rates help certain sectors.
They do, like financials. Second, geopolitical spending. Increased defense spending is driving industrial growth. And third, AI innovation is penetrating the continent, especially in key areas like specialized semiconductors and power generation.
And structurally, Europe is just a very different market from the U.S., which makes the valuation argument so striking.
That's the core thesis. The U.S. market is incredibly top-heavy. Tech accounts for 35% of the S&P 500. Europe, however, is far more defensive and cyclical. 25% of the market is financials, and about 50% is a combination of financials, healthcare, and industrials.
So what's the key realization that justifies this rotation?
Here it is. If you take out the U.S. magnificent seven tech giants from the S&P 500, the remaining index has actually gained less than Europe over the past 5 years.
Wow.
And European valuations, which are currently trading at a discount of about 25% to the U.S. index, they haven't fully adjusted to this new growth environment. That suggests substantial catch-up potential.
Let's dive into the specific stock recommendations that came out of the Barron's Roundtable, starting where the rate normalization has the clearest impact of financials.
Indeed. Negative interest rates after the financial crisis just crushed European bank earnings. But now normal policy rates, the ECB is finally above zero, are boosting earnings tremendously, primarily through better net interest margins from deposits and lending.
And there were three strong recommendations here.
Yes, all trading at single-digit price-to-earnings multiples. First, Banco Bilbao Vizcaya Argentaria, or BBVA, in Spain, which has strong exposure to high-growth Latin America.
Okay.
Second is Austria-based Erste Group Bank, which is heavily exposed to the rapidly growing Central and Eastern European market. Both are seeing robust loan growth and are trading just above book value. Pre-financial crisis, they traded at twice book value, so the valuation discount is clear.
And the third one?
The third is BNP Paribas, which is highlighted as more of a deep capital markets value play. The push for self-reliance in Europe necessitates deeper capital markets to compete with the U.S., and BNP is strategically positioned to capitalize on that growth.
You mentioned an enormous potential catalyst related to bank capital requirements. Let's dig into that Tier 1 ratio concept.
This is structural gold. Post-financial crisis overregulation resulted in European banks holding Tier 1 capital ratios around 15%.
And Tier 1 is basically a measure of financial strength.
It's the core measure, yes. It's equity and disclosed reserves. And holding 15% is higher than many analysts believe is strictly necessary for stability.
Well, so if they relax those requirements.
If regulators were to relax these requirements, even slightly, experts estimate that a 1% cut in capital requirements could spur 100 billion euros of credit growth in Europe.
100 billion.
It would be profoundly powerful for the banks by freeing up capital for buybacks and dividends and for the broader economy by driving investment. That earnings acceleration isn't fully priced in yet.
That's a serious lever. The second major sector benefiting from normalization in geopolitics is defense. This feels like a permanent shift, not just a cyclical bump.
It is absolutely a multi-decade structural story. This isn't just a reaction to Ukraine. We are constructive on BAE Systems, formerly British Aerospace. Historically seen as a low-growth company, it is now growing at high single digits with improving margins.
And this is driven by secure long-term programs.
Exactly. 20 to 25-year government programs across air, maritime, and land systems.
Is this theme priced efficiently? Because we've heard about some spectacular gains in names like Rheinmetall.
You have to be selective now, because the valuation surge is a warning sign in some areas. The theme is powerful enough that it's spread across countries. Kongsberg Gruppen in Norway, Thales in France, and Rheinmetall in Germany.
And Rheinmetall is the one that's run up.
Right. Rheinmetall, for instance, is trading at a significant premium after gains of 40% to 50% this year. That valuation largely reflects Germany's commitment to serious spending. The country is now committing to serious defense spending, theoretically around 3% of GDP annually.
So investors need to be careful.
They do. While the underlying commitment to defense infrastructure is long-term, some names have already run hard on the expectation.
Moving to something less industrial, luxury. The investment case here hinges entirely on a variable factor, the Chinese consumer.
The China consumer recovery is the core bet for the major luxury houses like LVMH, Moët Hennessy, Louis Vuitton, and Richemont.
And what's the news there?
The good news is that while Chinese luxury sales are still slightly down for the year compared to a massive rebound, the declines are much less steep than they were earlier in the year when confidence was low.
So what's the hope?
The underlying hope is twofold. That there is massive pent-up demand for high-end goods, and that easing property price declines, property being a significant store of wealth for Chinese households, will encourage consumers to regain confidence and start spending again on discretionary items. This is a monitoring point, but the stocks are positioning for a rebound.
That brings us to semiconductors and power, the AI ecosystem in Europe, which is less about software and more about specialized hardware.
This is where Europe's unique, often monopolistic strengths really shine. ASML Holding, the Netherlands-based lithography giant, is a non-replicable piece of the global semiconductor ecosystem.
They make the machines that make the chips.
They make the only machines that can make the most advanced chips, especially the extreme ultraviolet or EUV tools. China simply cannot replicate this technology. Its valuation is benefiting from the expectation that the industry will move to increasingly lithography-intensive process nodes expected in 2027 and beyond.
Meaning more tools, more revenue.
Exactly.
And the AI boom isn't just demanding faster chips, it's driving astronomical demand for electricity.
It's incredible. The AI data center build-out is translating directly into enormous power needs. McKinsey estimates that the incremental power needed over the next 5 years will be 126 gigawatts.
Which is a staggering number.
It's absolutely staggering. It's more than double the entire nuclear output of French utility EDF's 56 nuclear reactors. Mm. This massive sustained demand is a huge positive for utilities.
Any specific recommendations?
Ilie's Enel is specifically recommended. It's trading cheaply at under 13 times earnings compared to U.S. utilities at 22 times. Enel is an integrated utility, meaning it benefits from volatility in power prices because it owns the generation assets, the customers, and the distribution network, making it resilient.
Finally, we had deep value picks in pharma and telecom.
Yes. Roche Holding is highlighted as deeply undervalued, trading at less than 13 times forward earnings. It boasts a unique diagnostics business that can inform and speed up its drug development side.
And they have a big Alzheimer's opportunity.
They do. A promising Alzheimer's blood test and a drug in phase 3 trials targeting that massive market. An opportunity that the market simply isn't pricing in because of overall sector worries.
And in telecoms.
French Orange is cited as a deep value play, trading at about 6 times enterprise value to EBITDA. It stands to benefit hugely from potential industry consolidation in France and the ongoing operational improvement in its Spanish business, both of which will lead to a growing, reliable cash flow stream.
It sounds like the investment case for Europe is solid, but what's the structural risk or the potential catalyst that hasn't materialized yet?
Well, the major cultural difference highlighted is investor behavior. Less than 60% of European equities are owned locally.
Compared to over 80% in the U.S.
Right. This means this recent rally has largely been driven by foreign flows. European investors still harbor significant risk aversion. If that culture shifts and European households adopt a home bias, rotating capital out of low-yielding bonds and into their own equities, that could be the huge sustained catalyst that drives valuations much higher. But that capital rotation hasn't happened yet.
That sets the stage perfectly for the core anxiety dominating U.S. markets right now, AI spending. Let's transition to the U.S. tech darling. NVIDIA delivered spectacular earnings, yet the stock sold off immediately after the beat. What's going on?
It's the definition of a worrywart market. It's a sophisticated expression of profit-taking cloaked in existential fear.
But the numbers were great.
The numbers were unequivocally spectacular. Q3 revenue up 62% year over year to $57 billion. Data center revenue up 66% to $51.2 billion. Q4 guidance was robust. The market had already priced in spectacular. But when spectacular lands, investors start looking for the fault line.
So why the fear?
It boils down to a massive speculative fear about the entire AI spending cycle. As Alliance Chief Economic Advisor Mohamed El Arian articulated, AI is in a rational bubble.
A rational bubble.
The payoff is potentially world-changing, which justifies massive overinvestment and overspending now, but there will only be a small number of ultimate winners. The collective worry is about the sheer volume of capital spending. JP Morgan estimates up to $7 trillion of borrowing.
$7 trillion.
Required globally to build out the necessary data centers, without a guaranteed commensurate return for all the players involved, especially the hyperscalers doing the spending.
And the market's fears were fueled by some high-profile critiques, especially the one concerning depreciation.
That's right. Michael Burry, the famed investor from The Big Short, amplified a critique claiming that big tech companies were inflating profits by extending the useful life of AI hardware, specifically NVIDIA's GPUs, to 6 years, up from a traditional 3 or 4.
And NVIDIA's CFO responded directly to that.
She did. Colette Kress specifically countered this by citing real data. A100 TPUs shipped 6 years ago are still running at full utilization today. That justifies the longer depreciation cycle based on actual productive lifespan. The hardware is simply lasting longer and remaining useful.
So if the CFO countered the critique with concrete data on A100 utilization, why did the stock still sell off? Does this show the worrywart market narrative is just an excuse for profit-taking, or is the market looking past the current quarter?
I think it's both. Firstly, the run-up had been immense, so profit-taking was inevitable. Secondly, the market is forward-looking and skeptical. They're looking past the current H100 cycle and worrying about the next big spending wave, specifically whether customers will suddenly hold off on purchasing the next generation, like Blackwell.
They want certainty.
They want certainty that this accelerating growth can be sustained well into 2027.
What were the key bullish signals that might have been overlooked amid all this volatility and anxiety?
Two things, I think, confirm the cycle has robust legs and accelerated growth. First, revenue growth accelerated year over year for the first time in nearly 2 years. This suggests the current server product cycle is incredibly robust and has several quarters of momentum left.
And the second thing.
Second, and this is even more crucial, networking revenue surged 162% year over year. A cloud executive noted that networking products, the components that connect all the GPUs together, are often purchased 4 to 6 months in advance of the actual data center buildouts.
So it's a leading indicator.
It's a huge leading indicator.
Yeah.
This networking surge signals future, sustained infrastructure construction and guaranteed future demand.
And then there's the comically small dividend, a penny per share. Why does that matter in the grand scheme of market history? It seems insignificant given the scale of their revenue.
It matters because it is a powerful historical and psychological warning sign about market euphoria. Across the S&P 500, the current dividend yield of 1.1% is near the lowest level seen in the last 3 decades.
Dangerously close to the dot-com bubble lows.
Exactly. The only time cash payments to shareholders were this derided and minimized was just before the 2000 crash, which saw the S&P 500 lose nearly half its value.
So the dividend isn't just a number. It's a social signal that investors prioritize pure price momentum and risk over established financial stability.
That's a fascinating psychological indicator.
It is. Dividends historically contribute 85% of long-term total returns, and critically, they offer downside protection. During big downturns since 1975, dividend payers lost only 14.4% on average versus 28.2% for non-payers.
And NVIDIA has the cash. Staggering free cash flow, $151 billion expected next year. But they prioritize massive reinvestment and buybacks over increasing the $1 billion annual dividend cost. The dividends is essentially a vestigial tailbone of finance, signaling that investors are content to forego stability for the promise of pure future price gains, which is classic bubble dynamics.
That contrast risk preference over stability leads us perfectly to the company formerly known as MicroStrategy, now simply Strategy. Their common stock is scary, down 50% since July. But the sources suggest a deep dive into the preferred stock yields a surprisingly attractive proposition.
This is a classic. Well, it's a financial segmentation play, meticulously designed by Chairman Michael Saylor. Strategy's existence is based on its crypto treasury strategy. They hold an astonishing $55 billion in Bitcoin,
which is about 3% of all outstanding Bitcoin.
Right. So the common stock is highly volatile. It moves in near lockstep with Bitcoin. However, for investors comfortable with crypto exposure who also desire high yield, the preferred stock is designed to be much less volatile and offers exceptionally high, consistent income.
The company has a low junk B-minus rating, though. What makes the preferred so attractive despite that default risk?
The yields are the attraction. Strategy's preferreds carry dividend yields ranging from 10% to 15%. That's dramatically higher than preferreds from major safe banks like JP Morgan, which yield around 6%.
And the risk mitigation argument.
It's compelling because of the asset backing. The CEO, Phong Lo, confirmed they could sell high basis Bitcoin. Bitcoin they acquired at a higher price to cover the $700 million annual dividend payment. Strategy even tweeted, perhaps hyperbolically, that at current Bitcoin levels, they have 71 years of dividend coverage.
Assuming the price stays flat.
Assuming the price stays flat, yes.
And for income investors, there is a massive tax benefit baked into these preferred shares that makes the after-tax yield even more attractive.
This is the crucial nuance that sophisticated investors love. Because Strategy has minimal conventional operating income. It's essentially a holding company for Bitcoin. The preferred dividends they pay out are often considered a return of capital.
Meaning you defer taxes.
It means the holder defers paying taxes on that income until they sell the securities, which can often be a decade or more down the line. That tax deferral significantly boosts the real return.
Can you walk us through the hierarchy of the four preferred issues in more conversational detail, distinguishing the risk-reward?
Absolutely, because they target different risk appetites.
Mm-hmm.
First, you have Stretch. That's the largest and most liquid deal. It uses a variable rate structure, trading around $93 and yielding about 11%.
Okay, that's the stable one.
Right. Then there's Strike. It pays an 8% coupon but trades at a steep discount, around 75 cents on the dollar, pushing the current yield up to 11%. It also has a convertible feature, which gives you a speculative kicker.
What about the other two?
Strife trades around $94, yielding 10.5%. This is considered the most secure of the fixed rate issues because it has a unique cumulative feature. The dividend increases if a payment is ever missed.
And the riskiest.
That would be Stride. It's non-cumulative, meaning they don't have to make up missed payments. It trades around $67 for an almost 15% yield, making it the highest reward, but also the highest theoretical risk.
That is high risk, high reward territory, but with surprisingly strong asset backing. Moving now to a different corner of the tech market, Dell stock has tanked, down 28% since October 8th. What's the case for buying this tech dip?
The sharp sell-off was driven primarily by a wrinkle in the supply chain. Worries that rising memory chip costs would squeeze Dell's gross margins. Morgan Stanley even downgraded the stock on this concern.
But the bull case argues this is overblown.
It does, and I think convincingly. Their competitor Lenovo recently reported, and memory chip pricing didn't significantly hurt their margins. That suggests Dell's growth engine is strong enough to absorb the costs.
So what exactly is Dell's growth engine right now? It can't just be selling PCs.
Not at all. Dell's benefiting immensely from NVIDIA's success. They're positioning themselves as a premier AI server integrator. Servers using NVIDIA's data center chips are Dell's fastest growing business segment, comprising close to a fifth of their total sales.
And the technical detail here matters immensely, especially around cooling and integration.
It really does. Dell is the leader in integrating the new, powerful NVIDIA chips, like the upcoming Blackwell, into both air-cooled and, crucially, direct liquid cooling, or DLC servers.
And DLC is essential for the highest power chips.
It is, because air cooling is insufficient. The ability to integrate and deploy these complex, high-margin DLC systems is a massive competitive advantage. Management expects sales to grow 8% annually through 2030, led by its Infrastructure Solutions Group.
And the valuation looks compelling now, especially after that 28% drop.
With the stock trading at just 11 times 12-month forward earnings, down from a peak of over 15 times this year, it looks cheap relative to its growth trajectory. Analysts suggest it could return to its previous peak of $164, representing a significant 39% upside.
This case for Dell highlights a critical rotation happening in the market, shifting focus from companies focused on AI spending to companies focused on AI returns.
This is a critical macro shift that every investor must recognize. The hyperscalers, Meta, Oracle, Alphabet, Amazon, Microsoft, are planning a combined $500 to $600 billion in capital investments next year for data center buildouts.
And that spending requires massive borrowing.
It does, which dramatically increases interest expenses and, crucially, depresses return on equity, or ROE. Investors are now reallocating away from these CapEx-heavy stocks, which require borrowing to maintain growth, and into companies that are showing the results of AI adoption.
They are shifting toward companies that are returning cash to shareholders.
Precisely. Since the end of October, there's been clear data showing that companies returning relatively large amounts of cash through dividends and buybacks have outperformed those returning less. These cash return champions offer a less volatile, more certain return profile.
Can you give us a few examples of these cash return champions and what makes their model attractive right now?
Certainly. The list includes household names like General Motors, Pfizer, and American Eagle Outfitters. The model is attractive because they have relatively low capital expenditure requirements.
Right.
American Eagle, for instance, returned $276 million to shareholders this year while keeping its CapEx low, just about $90 million, and continuing to pay down debt. This focus on strong, resilient cash flow and direct shareholder returns is proving to be a highly resilient strategy in a market obsessed with high-risk, high-borrowing AI bets.
This discussion of volatility and cash flow naturally leads directly to retirement planning. For retirees, NVIDIA's dominance makes the market feel particularly vulnerable to a single, sharp pullback.
It's a profound concentration risk for retirees who simply cannot afford the kind of volatility we are discussing. NVIDIA now constitutes nearly 8% of the S&P 500.
And it's carrying most of the gain this year.
It's carrying $1.7 trillion of the index's total gain this year. If the AI trade loses steam, the entire S&P 500 is vulnerable to a sharp pullback. Retirees need portfolio shock absorbers immediately.
What are the clear, actionable steps retirees should take right now to mitigate this NVIDIA overload and concentration risk?
First, immediate rebalancing and diversification.
Well,
that means actively trimming overheated tech exposure, especially the mega cap momentum names, and rotating into asset classes that have lagged.
Like small and mid caps.
Exactly. Small mid cap stocks are attractive right now because they have more appealing valuations, are domestically focused, and tend to do well when interest rates decline. This provides true diversification away from the global tech giants.
And the classic 60-40 portfolio, is it finally safe again after the brutal, anomalous downturn of 2022?
The sources offer reassurance here. The 2022 downturn, where both stocks and bonds suffered simultaneous losses, was a rare anomaly caused by the Fed's aggressive steep rate hikes. Now, bonds are recovering their traditional role as portfolio ballast. The iShares Core U.S. Aggregate Bond ETF is up around 7% year-to-date, performing well. The classic 60-40 mix historically provides the lowest probability of a nominal loss over a 25-year period.
And RMDs, required minimum distributions, should be viewed as a rebalancing tool, not just a mandatory withdrawal.
Exactly. Investors subject to RMDs, currently age 73 and older, can strategically use these withdrawals to manage concentration risk. Proactively withdraw the RMD from an overweighted, tax-deferred sector, say, highly appreciated tech, and then use the cash proceeds to reinvest into an underweight asset class, like small caps or bonds, in a taxable account.
It's a proactive way to rebalance.
It's a proactive way to manage concentration risk using a mandatory mechanism.
And finally, the ultimate stabilizer, the cash cushion.
The rule of thumb for insulation is simple and effective. Keep up to 2 years' worth of portfolio withdrawals in cash. This is a critical protective measure. It ensures that you are not forced to sell assets at a loss during market turbulence merely to cover basic living expenses.
Cash provides peace of mind.
It's the ultimate stabilizer that provides peace of mind during downturns.
We did get an interesting counterpoint in the mailbag that strongly challenged the traditional 60-40 strategy entirely based on macro concerns we discussed earlier.
That's right. One reader argued that the 60-40 mix is outmoded because the fixed income component is still subject to the deleterious effect of profligate fiscal policy worldwide and persistent inflation pressures.
So they suggested an alternative.
A more dynamic alternative. A 502-525 mix, 50% growth stocks, 25% high yield value stocks with increasing dividends, and 25% gold miners and bullion. This mix is explicitly designed to better preserve capital and generate growth in the current environment of high government debt and persistent inflation risk.
That's a timely discussion in this volatile climate. Speaking of volatility, many investors are trying to find ETFs that promise safety or low correlation, but the sources warn there is a steep long-term cost for that security.
There is a significant measurable long-term price for safety. ETFs designed to promise lower volatility or income from covered calls, like the iShares MSCI USA Minimum Volatility Factor ETF or the JP Morgan Equity Premium Income ETF, they do a great job of protecting the downside during sharp drops.
But they lag over the long run.
They significantly lag the S&P 500 over the long run. Over the past 5 years, the S&P 500 has posted average annual returns around 15%. Neither of those safety-focused funds return more than 10% a year on average.
So you dampen the swings, but you lose out on compounding.
You lose substantial foregone long-term compounding returns, which is the engine of wealth creation.
And historical perspective suggests that trying to time or trade volatility is often a fool's errand.
It emphasizes patience and discipline. Bespoke Investment Group found that since 1993, buying and holding the S&P 500 index delivered a cumulative return of 12,274%. Compare that to a theoretical investor who only traded volatility owning the index only on days following a down market, which returned only 851%.
So buy and hold wins.
The best return came from simply ignoring the short-term noise and holding on.
But for those who do want to monetize the expected volatility around major events, the sources suggest an option strategy tied to the upcoming Fed meeting.
Yes. The highly anticipated December 10th FOMC rate decision is the next major volatility flashpoint. The suggested speculative move is to buy a strangle on the small-cap iShares Russell 2000 ETF, ticker IWM.
And why IWM?
The small-cap ETF is a key proxy for the domestic U.S. economy, as its constituents derive a high portion of their revenue domestically, making it highly sensitive to interest rate policy.
Let's break down that options jargon for listeners. What is a strangle, and what magnitude of movement does it require to succeed?
A strangle is a speculative strategy that involves simultaneously buying an out-of-the-money put option and an out-of-the-money call option, both expiring shortly after the event.
So you're betting on volatility, not direction.
Exactly. You are betting on a sharp move in the underlying asset, regardless of direction. To break even, the sharp reaction, either bullish or bearish, must be large enough to cover the cost of buying both options. It's intended to profit from a massive sharp reaction to the news.
That's a high-stakes, speculative play designed to capitalize on uncertainty. Shifting gears to global speculative opportunities, let's look at Asia. We have an Indian IPO frenzy coupled with stark warnings about tiny, fraudulent Asian stocks flooding U.S. markets.
India is experiencing a massive IPO frenzy right now. It's fueled by Indian retail investors pouring $3 billion a month into their systematic investment plans.
And that's led to huge jumps in recent listings.
Huge jumps. Companies like PhysicsWalla, Grow, and Urban Company have seen rapid gains of 30% to 50% quickly after debut.
The pipeline sounds enormous, with potential listings from Flipkart, PhonePe, and Jio platforms. Should foreign investors jump into this frenzy?
Caution is highly recommended. The current rush eerily echoes the 2020-21 frenzy, which saw many of those listed stocks crater by three quarters before eventually rebounding.
And many aren't profitable yet.
Exactly. Many companies, like Urban Company, are still high growth, but not yet profitable. The smart advice here is twofold. Either wait until profitability can be clearly measured to justify the valuation, or stick to stable, boring blue chip India names that domestic newbies ignore but trade at cheap valuations.
Now, for the stark warning on the tiny Asian stocks flooding NASDAQ listings, this sounds like an area rife with danger and potential manipulation.
It is a severe high-risk area. We are seeing dozens of very small companies, ranging from hot pot restaurants to obscure consulting firms, all incorporated in Caribbean tax havens, but operating primarily in China, Hong Kong, or Southeast Asia, flooding onto NASDAQ.
And these are tiny offerings.
Tiny. Since 2023, more than three quarters of these offerings have raised less than $10 million. These stocks often surge dramatically, doubling or tripling on their first day, but these sharp surges are often created by coordinated manipulation.
We have concrete, illustrative examples of this manipulation.
The case of Feton Holdings is classic. This is a Chinese healthcare company with less than $500,000 in annual sales and no profits. It surged nearly 700% after its IPO, only to plummet 95% the very next day.
And this is often promoted on social media.
Yes. By anonymous social media groups like WhatsApp chats, promising guaranteed returns, and sometimes falsely claiming big-name drug makers would buy a stake to lure in naive investors. The SEC is aware and acting, but the risk remains high.
So what are the red flags listeners should watch for to steer clear of these risky microcaps?
There are three critical structural warning signs. One, very small float. Look for companies offering 15% to 17% or less of their shares to the public. Small floats are easily manipulated.
Okay, what's number two?
Complex corporate structure. These companies often use multiple layers of holding companies in tax havens like the Cayman Islands or the British Virgin Islands, controlling subsidiaries in China. This screams lack of transparency. Regulatory awareness. Know that the SEC and NASDAQ are working to combat this. NASDAQ has proposed rules to expedite delisting and introduce a $25 million minimum offering threshold for companies principally operating in China. If the offering is tiny and the structure is complex, assume risk and steer clear.
That is a vital safety warning. Let's move into a deep dive on specific stock stories, starting with the drug maker Bristol Myers Squibb. The valuation here makes it look like a tremendous bargain, trading at just 7.5 times earnings.
It is truly a classic deep value situation. Bristol Myers trades at just 7.5 times earnings with a whopping 5.4% dividend yield.
Well above the industry average.
Way above the industry average of less than 4%. The stock is heavily discounted relative to its peers, who trade at an average PE of 12.5.
Why is the market punishing it so severely?
It's facing a brutal patent cliff. Revlimid has already lost exclusivity. Their two other mega blockbusters, Eliquis and Opdivo, face critical patent expiration challenges by 2028. This uncertainty has weighed heavily, causing the stock to drop 40% over the past 3 years.
The market sees the old revenue disappearing.
And is skeptical of the replacement plan.
So what's the detailed turnaround story that justifies buying the stock at this deep discount?
Management is executing a robust, multi-pronged strategy. They announced a $3.5 billion restructuring by 2027 to lower costs. Their financial strength is solid, reporting $6.3 billion in operating cash flow in Q3.
And their growth portfolio is now a majority of sales.
Crucially, yes. Their growth portfolio, New Generation Therapeutics, acquired through strategic M&A, now represents 57% of sales, effectively offsetting the decline in legacy drugs like Revlimid. They're also working to protect legacy sales by transitioning Opdivo to a new patent-protected formulation.
And what are the new blockbusters that will drive future growth?
Two new drugs stand out. Breyanzi, their newest oncology blockbuster, crossed $1 billion in annualized sales and saw a 60% revenue increase in the third quarter.
And the other one?
Even more promising is the early success of the antipsychotic Cobenfy. It has a groundbreaking mechanism that avoids the serious side effects common in traditional treatments. The total addressable market for schizophrenia treatments alone is estimated at $17 billion by 2031, giving Cobenfy massive potential.
So management has a clear path forward.
They're targeting being one of the sector's fastest growing companies by the decade's end, promising 10 new medicines by 2030. The deep discount means investors are essentially paying for the confirmed growth portfolio and getting the legacy products and the huge dividend yield as a bonus.
From biopharma to entertainment and travel, Disney is making a major strategic bet on cruising, historically an ancillary business.
Disney is traditionally known for films and theme parks, but they are absolutely going big on cruise ships, which are extremely high-margin businesses.
Mm.
They recently bolstered their fleet with the Treasure, launched the Destiny, and expect their largest ship, the Adventure, in March.
This fleet expansion is massive.
It is.
What's the financial necessity behind this huge fleet expansion, given the capital requirements?
Growth and diversification. This new fleet capacity is expected to add over $2.8 billion in revenue and over $500 million in operating income for Disney next year.
And this is essential because theme park demand is facing competition.
Exactly. Particularly with Comcast opening Universal's Epic Universe in Orlando this year, along with persistent inflation headwinds cutting into family travel budgets. Disney noted that while park demand was in line with expectations, cruise demand was very, very strong.
So the cruise line is a new growth vector.
It's now a crucial, positive focal point for investors, offering a resilient, high-margin growth vector.
Let's turn our attention to the corporate activity roundup, starting with activist investors and their key 13D filings for the week.
We saw several key activist plays. Shaw Capital increased its stake in Novavax to 8.3%. They issued an open letter pushing for the company to be acquired by a larger, competent pharma company, citing major frustrations with the new Vaxovid rollout.
Okay, what else?
Separately, Brother Rhodes switched to an activist stance on UniFirst, holding a 4.9% stake, aiming to influence corporate direction.
And movement from private equity and venture capital.
Yes. CD&R increased its stake in Resideo Technologies to 19.9%, hitting its pre-agreed standstill cap. On the biotech side, Third Rock Ventures reduced its stake in Tango Therapeutics after the stock had surged 164.7% year-to-date.
A well-timed profit-taking move.
A very well-timed move after a successful clinical trial run.
Now let's talk about the big names in hedge funds. David Tepper, one of the most successful investors on Wall Street, made some interesting contrarian Q3 bets that run completely counter to the market momentum.
Tepper's Appaloosa management made a distinct rotation away from momentum. They initiated large positions in deeply out-of-favor companies. They bought about 5.2 million shares of Whirlpool, which is down over 40% this year.
And American Airlines and Goodyear.
They did. They also initiated a position in American Airlines and purchased 4.3 million shares of Goodyear, a stock that is off 40% over the past 2 years.
These sound like pure value bets, betting on cyclicals and industrials that the market has abandoned for the promise of AI.
Exactly. And at the same time, Tepper eliminated a major position of 8 million shares of Intel at chipmaker, but one that missed the initial AI boom and reduced his holding in United Health. It suggests a rotation into deeply discounted cyclicals and industrials.
We also have a roundup of analyst reports from the week. What stood out in enterprise IT and retail tech?
Several key calls. IBM was reinforced as a macro-resistant hybrid IT AI leader set for growth. Analysts see multiple vectors for growth there.
Mm-hmm.
In retail, Lowe's cleared a very low bar in Q3, outperforming Home Depot. Analysts highlighted the early traction of their proprietary agentic technology and the Milo agent, which is doubling conversion rates for DIY customers.
And in financial technology, we saw an alarming report about insider sales at PayPal.
Wait, a 14% drop post-earnings followed by $1.5 million in insider sales. That is a huge red flag that requires immediate attention.
Who was selling?
Three PayPal executives, including the chief accounting officer and the global chief risk officer. This reflects a sustained investor and apparently insider doubt about the company's competitive advantage in a crowded field, despite management's claims of a turnaround plan.
The people with the deepest knowledge are selling.
It confirms investor skepticism, yes.
We transition now to a politically charged topic, but we emphasize our role is to impartially analyze the facts and policies presented in the source material. The sources looked at the economic record of the Trump administration, offering 10 things to be grateful for this Thanksgiving from an economic policy perspective.
Indeed. This was based on a commentary piece that acknowledged discussing this might spoil the holiday dinner, referencing the contentious nature of policy debate. The author, a former senior economic policy advisor in the Obama administration, acknowledged that while tariffs and tax cuts have created budget holes, there are perceived pro-growth policies that deserve recognition.
Let's expand on 3 or 4 of those 10 economic actions that stand out for their impact and long-term consequences.
Certainly. Let's start with NATO defense spending. Getting NATO members to commit to spending 5% of GDP on defense by 2032 was a goal none of Trump's predecessors achieved. This is forcing massive capital expenditure in allied nations like Germany.
Right, which boosts the defense sector we discussed earlier.
Exactly. Second, the policy of expensing capital expenditures. Making permanent the practice of allowing businesses to expense capital expenditures all at once, rather than depreciating them over years, provides a meaningful and immediate incentive for businesses to invest.
That structural change in depreciation rules is often overlooked, but has huge implications for corporate investment decisions. What about the digital economy?
That leads to the Genius Act and stablecoins. Championing the Genius Act, which set a framework for dollar-linked stablecoins, is viewed as critical. By positioning the U.S. at the center of the digital currency system, the U.S. can ensure its financial dominance.
A competitive win.
A huge competitive win. Finally, let's look at Middle East stability. The effort to deliver stability, specifically working towards Saudi Arabia recognizing Israel, is viewed as an economic masterstroke. This has the potential to connect vast Gulf investment pools with Israel's world-class innovation and technology sectors.
And the remaining points?
They focus on supply chain resilience and global trade. Things like unintentionally forcing Canada to eliminate internal trade barriers, simplifying regulation for small businesses, expanding semiconductor production efforts here in the U.S., and establishing frameworks for rare earth supply chains. The core takeaway is that these actions represent high-impact structural changes.
That's a comprehensive view of the policy impact. Mm. Let's shift dramatically now from geopolitics to the future of medicine, AI, and healthcare. The premise here is that AI won't replace your doctor, but it could make you a much better patient.
This is about practical, beneficial application in the clinic. AI, specifically generative AI, is better than a simple internet search on Google or WebMD because it offers personalization, clarity, and summarization. Patients can use it to overcome medical gobbledygook.
So it can translate a TAT scan result into plain English.
Exactly. It can explain complex medical documents at a concise, easy-to-digest reading level.
So it's a tool for preparation, not diagnosis. And what are the broader business model implications here for the healthcare system?
It's a tool for preparation, yes, but it drives massive efficiency gains for providers. AI's value starts before the office visit. Patients can use it to refine symptoms, organize their thoughts, and generate high-quality questions. A query about high blood pressure, for example, can generate 6 key questions for the doctor.
Making the visit more efficient.
Vastly more efficient. If AI streamlines diagnostics and note-taking, the estimated cost savings for major hospital systems could run into the billions annually.
But there are clear risks and caveats to relying on AI in medicine that listeners need to be aware of.
The primary risk is that AI is only as good as the input you give it. Incomplete information or poorly phrased questions can lead the AI astray, resulting in irrelevant or scary answers.
Right.
Furthermore, asking AI for the worst possible diagnosis for a symptom, like a neck lump, can lead to immediate patient anxiety and demand for unnecessary tests, overwhelming the medical system. AI cannot substitute for a doctor's physical examination and contextual judgment.
So how will AI ultimately integrate into the medical practice?
It will likely take over mundane administrative tasks entirely, freeing up physicians to spend more time on complex patient interaction. This includes automated note-taking and monitoring of massive amounts of data flowing from wearable devices, blood pressure, arrhythmias, blood sugar levels.
So it becomes a proactive monitoring tool.
It could eventually monitor all this ambient data, alerting both patients and doctors only to genuinely worrisome developments, shifting healthcare from reactive to proactive. So what does this all mean? The core theme running through this week's analysis is one of fundamental transition. The global financial map is being redrawn not just by the explosive pace of AI innovation, but critically by geopolitical and fiscal shifts forcing major policy changes.
Uh-huh.
We see Japan potentially shutting off global liquidity and Europe struggling with fiscal constraints imposed by the bond vigilantes. But these shifts also create unique pockets of deep value and structural opportunity. Notably, the broad revival we are seeing in Europe and the deep overlooked value in sectors like biotech, exemplified by Bristol-Myers Squibb.
And for you, the listener, the most actionable insight here is how to position for a violently flat market one, defined by sharp, rapid moves, but no clear overall direction. Given the intense AI capital expenditure driving volatility and depressing ROE among hyperscalers, the safest bet for informed investors right now is leaning into the classic defensive attributes. Low volatility, high cash flow, and strong shareholder returns.
That is the prudent path.
It is, unless you are comfortable navigating the highly speculative, high-yield territory like MicroStrategy preferreds or foreign IPO frenzies, which demand immense due diligence and a high-risk tolerance.
That leads to our final provocative thought. The reader mailbag challenged the traditional 60-40 model due to a global profligate fiscal policy, arguing for diversification into high-yield value stocks. We then saw that David Tepper, one of the most successful investors on Wall Street, is making massive contrarian bets on deeply beaten down industrial stocks like Whirlpool and Goodyear right now.
So the question is,
does this rotation by one of Wall Street's sharpest minds suggest that the flight from fundamentals and into high momentum, high capex AI stocks is overdue for a reckoning? Is value finally ready for its massive comeback in 2026?
Until next time, keep digging.